You're listening to Midori House first broadcast on the 21st of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Markus Hippi, and Clemency Burton-Hill.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's news agenda with Martin Plaut, fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. What do you have for us today, Martin?
Well, it's the UN Security Council this week considers what to do about Eastern Congo and its many armed groups, while the European Union considers how to tackle organised crime worth 680 billion euros a year. And what I do with a few thousand pounds, the joy of London's auction markets.
More from Martin a bit later. We'll also be asking what's on the agenda as US Secretary of State John Kerry tours Europe to meet some key leaders from the Middle East.
And we'll head over to a brutal exhibition set amongst piles of rubble and broken pipelines.
You'll be wandering around the show and suddenly five lads stripped to the waist with gas masks on will be running through the thing, dragging metal bars and doing insane dance moves.
We'll also be finding out what art exhibitions are a must-see in Montreal this winter.
There's a couple of interesting festivals starting up. One is Phenomena, which is it's very unique. I can't imagine it happening anywhere outside of Quebec. And it's this interesting fusion of sort of bizarre poetry and cabaret and a fixation with sort of Dada and surrealism.
All that, plus a check of the Brazilian front pages, and we play some great music too. All to come here on the next hour on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with David Spencer.
Thank you. Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. There's a warning that a number of bushfires burning close to Sydney could converge over the next few days. Firefighters are struggling to control dozens of blazes, and warmer temperatures and stronger winds are forecast on Wednesday as the flames threaten more homes. A state of emergency has been declared in New South Wales, where hundreds of houses have already been destroyed. Fire Service Commissioner Shane Fitzsimmons says there hasn't been any forced evacuations.
We are seeing, continuing to see, a very responsive, a very measured, a very considered community that's heeding advice and making decisions and, where appropriate, choosing to relocate and follow that advice.
The Mexican government has criticised the United States over new allegations of spying after a German magazine reported that the US National Security Agency had hacked Philippe Calderon's public email account while he was president. The latest leaks from former NSA contractor Edward Snowden follow previous claims about spying on the president of Brazil. Mexico said the spying could affect relations between the two countries. The Brazilian government is deploying troops on the streets of Rio de Janeiro ahead of a major auction for oil exploration rights. President Dilma Rousseff has ordered tighter security after violent demonstrations in Rio last week. Anti-government protesters have also threatened to march on the auction, which many people in Brazil oppose. Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has begun a four-day visit to the United States as the two countries try to improve relations. Talks over the next few days are likely to focus on Pakistan opposition to US drone strikes and Washington's complaints about the ties of the Pakistani intelligence service to militant groups in Afghanistan. US Secretary of State John Kerry greeted Mr. Sharif in Washington ahead of the discussions.
The relationship with Pakistan could not be more important. On its own, a democracy that is working hard to get its economy moving and deal with insurgency, and also important to the regional stability. So we're very happy to have you here, Mr. Prime Minister.
French utility company EDF and the British government have signed an agreement to build two nuclear reactors for a total cost of £16 billion. EDF said it would have a 45 to 50% stake in the consortium to build Britain's first new nuclear power plant for a generation. China General Nuclear Corporation and China National Nuclear Corporation will have a combined stake of 30 to 40%. Prime Minister David Cameron said it marks the next generation of nuclear power in Britain. The European Court of Human Rights is to rule on Russia's handling of its inquiry into a 1940 massacre of more than 20,000 Polish war prisoners by Soviet secret police. 15 relatives of the victims have claimed that Russia failed to carry out an adequate investigation by preventing them from finding out the truth. Soviet Russia only admitted to the atrocity in 1990, after blaming the Nazis for five decades. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, David. We'll see you at the bottom of the hour. This is Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
16.06 in Tokyo, 8.06 here in London, 3.06 a.m. in New York City. You are listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. Time now to set the day's news agenda. Joining us today is Martin Plaut, fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies and former BBC Africa editor. Welcome to the programme.
Morning.
What do you want to start with today, Martin?
Well, I thought we'd just look at what's coming up today in the UN Security Council. They are having a report back from a mission they sent out to Congo. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but the Security Council takes little trips out to see terrible places that they're worried about. And they went off to see Eastern Congo and then went into Rwanda, Uganda, and on to Ethiopia. And they're going to now consider what on earth to do about the absolute mess that is the eastern half of Congo. This is an area which is riddled with rival military groups, with armed groups, and in which every single country along the border has a stake. And that is the difficulty, especially as you have Rwanda as one of the members of the Security Council who was on this trip, but is also having a stake in the fighting in the eastern Congo. So it's a terribly difficult one to sort out.
Martin, is there any sense that the talks in Kampala and that any of this observation, negotiation, will actually create any kind of useful outcome in terms of that tension?
Well, in theory, it could be done. Mary Robinson, who's the former president of Ireland, is running, trying to bring everything together. And the only way it can be done is if every bit of this puzzle is in place.
That's quite a big if.
It is a very, very big if, because the other half of it is that many of the military groups, and particularly, say, the Ugandan or the Rwandan military, have a personal stake in the war continuing because of the rich minerals that can be extracted. And you can then get a share of that resource. So that is why they want the conflict, in a sense, to continue, while at the same time wishing to keep it under control and not be accused of being involved. Because for example, the United States just imposed sanctions on Rwanda for directly being involved through the rebel group, the M23.
And when it comes to today, indeed, the Security Council will be briefed. So are there going to be any surprises in the discussions?
I doubt it. There isn't, frankly, much that we don't know about. And really, the deal has to be done in Kampala between the various forces that are negotiating there, the Ugandans, the Rwandans and the Congolese. If they can bring everything together, then perhaps we could see things being sorted out. The M23 rebels, who are backed by Rwanda, want to be reintegrated into the Congolese army. Problem with that is it's been done many times before. And frankly, it never works, because as soon as things get tough, they just deintegrate themselves and go back into the bush.
Can we focus on Rwanda for a moment? Because as you say, it's an irony in a sense that Rwanda has a seat on the Security Council. And indeed, in the briefings today, as I understand it, the UK and I think the US are actually going to be briefing about Rwanda, and then Rwanda themselves are going to be briefing about the situation in Addis. How does that play out in terms of the diplomacy within the room, and how, in terms of this Rwanda being both a key part of on one side, but also a huge part of the discussions on the other? How does that actually
Absolutely,
work?
Absolutely, especially when the Americans are imposing sanctions
exactly.
against them. It is a mess, but that is the sort of mess that the diplomats are used to working with.
Will it all be very diplomatic, or will there be tensions in the room?
I think the tensions must have already been. Everyone knows what the story is. This isn't a surprise to anybody, so I doubt whether there'll be any banging of the table. I think they'll get over this. Everybody knows what's going on. There's nothing unusual about it. So I think this is just life as normal for the UN.
And Martin, moving on to your second story. This week, the European Union will discuss what to do with its relationship with Africa.
Well, and particularly also what to do about organised crime, because, you know, we've seen those terrible, terrible stories and the images of people drowning off Italy, the island of Lampedusa, mostly Eritreans and Somalis. But behind that, there is the hand of organised crime, because these people are being shipped across by groups that make money out of it, and they're just one tiny element of this, because you have something like 800,000 women and children who are brought across by people smugglers. You have 50 tons of cocaine brought across Africa from Latin America for the European market. All of these things fall under the heading of organized crime. They all have the mafia, and groups like the mafia are involved in this. And this is the underbelly of Europe, which is seldom talked about, but it is a vast 670 billion euro worth of the economy every year.
And it's not as if European economies are in the sort of state where they can cope with 670 billion losses. What can be done about this? I mean, in particular, looking at the drug situation, you mentioned those 50 tons of cocaine. It's almost a decade since the UN first rang alarm bells, pointing out that drugs, cocaine in particular, was being trafficked from Latin America, from the Andes, through West Africa, and staggering cost every year. Since then, hundreds of thousands of dollars have been pumped into try and counter that. And now they've got this 2013 drugs report that actually shows that it's hardly made any impact whatsoever.
Well, I think the only thing to do would be to be honest and really publish a report which named names. There are countries now like some of the Equatorial Guinea and Guinea-Bissau, which are frankly drugs cartels themselves. Plus you have people like, there are elements of the Nigerian government. Everybody knows who they are, who are completely and utterly involved in organised crime. That is what required. People need to name names.
And why haven't these names been named this far?
Money. It's too much money. And, I mean, for example, if you're going to name who is involved in the smuggling of oil in Nigeria, frankly, people are going to die. And probably people in Shell and the other SO, people like that, because, you know, everyone knows what's going on.
But
there's,
as
no
you say, tens of thousands of people are dying every year through organised crime and its related nefarious networks. I'm just intrigued to hear about this holistic approach to the drugs trafficking that the EU are taking, which is to concentrate on the entire cocaine route. This is the Cocaine Route Programme. It takes in 36 countries. Do you hold out any hope, Martin, that that might actually combat the problem?
Not a lot. I think the only thing that might really spur people to do something is that it also funds the Al-Qaeda groups in the Islamic Maghreb, and everybody knows that as well. So, you know, if you want to deal with Al-Qaeda in this area, you really have to tackle the cocaine, because that's where they're getting a lot of their money from.
And also when it comes to a lot of refugees, immigrants and asylum seekers from Africa, Italy in the forefront has been asking for support when it comes to controlling the situation, trying at least, in the Mediterranean. Do you think the European Union can actually get something substantial created?
I have my doubts. I mean, you know, who wants to take more refugees? It just isn't a popular call by any government. I mean, you know, Sweden has had problems with this. Britain doesn't want to have any more. The French are trying to get rid of them. So, you know, where is the happy home? I don't see it.
So rather a grim agenda for
so.
The EU. Let's talk about a happier thing. Well, happy for someone who gets to buy it. A Picasso plate is up for auction this week. Rather extraordinarily beautiful object. Martin, would you fancy this if you had the pockets were deep enough?
Oh, if I was a rich man. Yes, yes, yes. I'd love to be going along to Bonhams this week. They have this beautiful plate. They have, in fact, quite a range of Picasso material. It shows one of his favourite scenes, which was the bullfight. And you have these wonderful bulls on the edge of it. And, you know, this is just one of 200, you know, that he made. This is not a one-off. He made an edition of 200. And it's up for around about 3,000 to 4,000 euros. Now, I don't have that kind of money. But it does go to show what is on the market in London every single week. This is the sort of jewel that you can pick up. I mean, you're into the arts. Wouldn't you love having one of these on your wall?
I would absolutely love to have one on my wall. I'm intrigued by this because it's monochrome. It's not necessarily what you might expect when you think of Picasso ceramics. You tend to think of those riots of colour and those rather naive pre-cubist images, whereas this is not necessarily... I've never seen a Picasso image like this. And yes, I would like it on my wall, if not my dinner table. 3,000 to 4,000 euros. I mean, obviously, it's beyond the realms of possibility for most of us, but it's not... absolutely extortionate, is it to own
absolutely.
An actual Picasso?
And
what I was thinking about is probably a good investment as well. So basically, if you get that money, which is not... it is not that much for a Picasso, you know, if you keep it for a decade or two, you can actually make quite a profit.
I think that's true, although one's got to be very careful of the art market. The art market goes down as well as up. For example, did you know that armour has never returned to the value that it was in 1900? It was hugely collectible. Nobody's
but a Picasso, surely a Picasso is going to hold its worth.
Yes. How many of you have actually been into an art auction and bought anything?
Well, obviously not with my paltry 50 quid or something I could throw at it. But
No?
I've longed and lusted after it.
Same here.
Martin Flout, we'll have to leave it there. Fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies and former BBC Africa editor, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning.
Coming up in the programme, US Secretary of State John Kerry travels to Europe today to meet up with some key leaders from the Middle East. Stay tuned.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexus.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
Welcome back. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. After an initial meeting on the Arab Peace Initiative in Paris last month, US Secretary of State John Kerry travels to Europe today to follow up those negotiations. He'll be back in Paris as well as London and Rome to meet with key leaders, including the Saudi Foreign Minister, the Israeli Prime Minister and a slew of top UK ministers.
Details of what each meeting will entail are still being finalised, but it's safe to suggest that high up on the agenda will be the Middle East peace process, the ongoing conflict in Syria and a possible rapprochement with Iran following the unexpectedly positive noises that emerged from those nuclear negotiations in Geneva last week. Well, joining us on the line to give us his take on what we can expect is Fawaz Jerjes, Professor of Middle Eastern Politics and International Relations at the London School of Economics. Good morning, Fawaz. Thank you very much for joining us. I gather you're just back from Egypt yourself.
Yes, I mean, I think this week really is a very important week, as you know, because... there are some very major, challenges on the agenda. In particular, the Syrian peace conference, the so-called Geneva Number 2, and also the relations between the Western powers and Iran, not to mention the peace process. But I would argue that the Iranian portfolio and the Syrian peace conference in Geneva 2 are the most urgent questions on the agenda of world diplomacy this week.
And we're looking at this week, if everything goes, you know, according to Kerry's plan, what will be achieved?
Well, I don't think everything will go according to John Kerry's plans for a variety of reasons. First, there are some major challenges within the Syrian portfolio. I think the most important priority for the Western powers, for the United States and Britain and France, is to convince the Syrian opposition to present and send a unified and an effective delegation to Geneva too. As you know, there are some major differences within the Syrian opposition. Even the nature and the composition of the Syrian opposition is not finalized yet, not even whether the Syrian opposition would be able to attend the conference. Secondly, I think what we need to understand is that Saudi Arabia and Israel have emerged as major opponents. They have opposed any kind of rapprochement between Iran on the one hand and the Western powers. They basically would like to maintain the sanctions against Iran. They do not believe that the Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, is genuine about disarmament. And that's why what John Kerry and the British and the French political leadership will be trying to do is to try to convince both the Israeli and the Saudi leadership that they are very genuine and very serious about finding a way out of the Iranian predicament, in particular Iran's nuclear program.
Fawaz, to what extent does that position, the position of Israel and Saudi Arabia, actually just serve their own national self-interests? And to what extent is it legitimate?
That is, you're absolutely correct. Keep in mind that Saudi Arabia and Israel probably are the only two states in the world who are basically trying to maintain the status quo vis-à-vis Iran. Those Saudi Arabia and Israel would like to counterbalance Iran in the Persian Gulf. They would like Iran to be forced to basically give up its nuclear program, period. They do not trust the Iranian leadership. They are basically sowing doubts about how genuine is the new Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, in his attempt to bridge the divide between the Western community, the international community, and Iran. And what we need to understand is that the Americans and the European powers are basically are trying to find out if Iran is genuine, if a way out can be found. And that's why, in fact, American and Western interests are no longer aligned with both Israel and Saudi Arabia, and that's why the tensions, and that's why the heightened rhetoric between Saudi Arabia and Israel on the one hand and the Western powers on the other.
Fawaz, how do the Western powers find out if Iran and President Rouhani is being genuine?
How do you find out without engagement? That is the first thing you have to do, and that's exactly what the Western powers are trying to do. They say, let's find out if President Hassan Rouhani can deliver. Let's find out if he is genuine about making concessions on Iran's nuclear program. Let's not really relieve the tensions and the sanctions against Iran without finding out. But at this particular point, I think the Israeli leadership, in particular the Prime Minister Netanyahu, does not want any kind of rapprochement with Iran. He's terrified. The reality is Netanyahu wants a military or military strikes against Iran as opposed to really finding a way out of the deadly embrace between the Western powers and Iran.
An important week ahead indeed. Thank you for your insights, Fawaz. That was Fawaz Gerges, Professor of Middle East Politics and International Relations at the London School of Economics.
Now, Montreal's notoriously brutal winter isn't far away, but the city hasn't shut down just yet. Emily Rain is the co-founder and arts and culture editor of Cult Montreal, the city's leading English language guide to its renowned underground culture. She sat down with Monocle's Montreal correspondent, Patrick Pittman. She sat down with Monocle's Montreal correspondent, Patrick Pittman, to talk about what's going on in the city right now.
There's a lot always in Montreal. One new art exhibit, it's actually a fairly large one that's on for the next few months at the Musée d'Art Contemporain de Montréal. And it's from Vancouver. It's called Beat Nation. And it's sort of investigating the ties between street culture and hip-hop and Aboriginal communities and brought together some of the best-known and most interesting contemporary young Aboriginal artists from all over Canada and the United States. Numerous nations are represented. And there's a lot of sort of remixed video installations. And throughout the whole thing, there's sort of this powwow beat. They got one of the guys from a tribe called Red participated. They do sort of, they call it powwow step, really a fusion of sort of Indian tribal beats and hip hop. And it's a great exhibit. It's sort of really, really interesting intersections between hip-hop culture and sort of subscribes to that backpacker ethos of hip-hop's bigger than just entertainment. We have to use it to be political. And so a lot of the projects that are involved in this exhibit are actually, I mean, quite overtly political, but also about trying to get reserve kids interested in Aboriginal history and to, you know, go back and learn the languages, and are the products of sort of community-oriented art projects. And just absolutely striking collection of art that feels really contemporary and really important right now in Canada.
Does the contemporary art audience in Montreal generally respond to Aboriginal art? Is there a place for it? Is this quite a new thing?
You see the odd thing, but it's often quite historical, you know, whereas this is very contemporary and sort of accepting that, you know, Native culture has changed over the last 250 years and it's not just bone sculptures and, you know, and they take this sort of line form aesthetic and things like that in their work. But it was interesting. I was talking to one of the curators in Montreal, or Quebec's very interesting because it developed differently in relation to the native population as it was being colonized, in that the French traders are very quick to embrace native life and to sort of intermarry. And the Quebecois population is highly Métis. Like, there is a lot of native blood in pretty much everyone, but it's never talked about. So I felt like this exhibit was a perfect way to sort of bring that conversation in a way that makes it interesting for young people too. And also, it's the kind of exhibit that, you know, I in earnest would send my friends to, which doesn't always happen in the sort of big publicly funded galleries. But to me, it was like any of my friends would enjoy it. It was it's just feels very contemporary and timely. And it is something that, you know, like most nations, Canada, we have to deal with that sort of dirty laundry in our heritage. So.
And so that one's on right now?
It's on right now. It opened on Wednesday and it's on through the beginning of January.
Montreal, this time of year, I've been looking at the weather forecast with something approaching terror. Winter's coming, shall we say, but art's not really shutting down just yet, is it?
It's not, actually. There's a couple of interesting festivals starting up. One is Phenomena, which is, it's very unique. I can't imagine it happening anywhere outside of Quebec. And it's this interesting fusion of sort of bizarre poetry and cabaret and a fixation with sort of Dada and surrealism, and they do kind of public interventions. They do numerous marionette and puppetry shows from all over the world, and especially France. And then kind of alternative, they're really interested in interdisciplinarity. So there's a lot of sort of dance inspired by Georges Méliès, the cinema pioneer. And sort of they do tableau vivant, just really unusual kind of art interventions, often very performative, that there isn't really a space for it, always at the borders of different things that are happening. So that's really exciting. And then next month, we're just wrapping up the Festival du Nouveau Cinéma, which is sort of our big international art show blockbuster festival. And then the next film festival that starts the week after that one closes is RIDM, which is our documentary festival. So that's exciting.
Montreal's always got some sort of festival on the go.
It's a festival town. Yeah, especially in the summer. It's almost exhausting. I mean, basically, our publication, we were monthly throughout the year. And then the summer, we literally had to double our output just because sometimes there'd be five or six really interesting festivals happening all at the same time. I mean, it's crazy. The number of options you can have on any given night in a July evening in Montreal, there'll be 30 things that you legitimately kind of want to do. But, you know, that's not possible. We always like to say that basically, or I always like to say that the winter lets us recover from the summer, because it's just a nonstop, very boozy, stay out all night culture. And we have so much light. And so everyone sort of stays out in the streets and parties until midnight. And then in the winter, we all read novels and hibernate. And nobody leaves their house between sort of November and February, kind of.
And what else is coming up?
There's a lot of interesting stuff around sort of smaller things. At the Phi Center, which is it's a very interesting space. It's in Montreal's old port, which is the section of the city that was first developed. So it's sort of like, I call it a cheap Europe, sort of that 17th century aesthetic. So there's this huge gallery down there that's this multi-purpose space. They have a venue in there. They have screening rooms. They have office space. They have several different galleries and a boutique as well. It's called the Phi Center. And what they've recently started doing is inviting Montrealers who have sort of pronounced international presence to take over the center and sort of avail themselves of its resources to present whatever kind of curated events they want. And this is the third one right now. Rod Hourani, who's sort of unisex, very conceptual designer from Montreal, who mainly lives in Paris now, has taken over. And so he's putting on a few different concerts. He's having Pierre Lapointe play, and as well as setting up a very well-curated boutique of designer clothing in there. And then he's also lined up a bunch of screenings and an art show of his pictures. So that's really exciting. Each person that's sort of taken over this center has done really interesting things with it. I believe Gavin McGinnis from Vice is the next curator, but it's sort of interesting to see, you know, to take someone who's very, very creative and very successful and be like, here's a huge space and an infinite amount of staff and resources, you have a month, go. And to see what they can sort of pull out of their pocket or what they decide they want their dream to be to have this space. The last one was actually Pop Montreal, which is the city's biggest kind of alternative or indie music festival. And it was interesting because they already have their festival, they already have the chance to have a venue. So what they did was use the space for a month and created a whole bunch of residencies and just sort of set a bunch of artists who weren't at the end actually responsible to produce anything or display anything, but just, here, you can use our resources. We have this great thing. You have a month, make stuff, go nuts. And then we'll see in the spring when we do our next presentation of, you know, shows or art fairs or whatever. So.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us and enjoy this last run of stuff before the ice sets in.
I can't wait to sleep all winter.
That was Monocle's Montreal correspondent Patrick Pietman talking to Emily Rain, arts and culture editor of Cult Montreal.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
This is Monocle 24. 24.
In the next half hour of the show, we'll leaf through today's Brazilian papers, we'll check in with our Madrid correspondent, who happens to be in Barcelona, and we'll head to a London art show, Brutal, that looks at the edgier aspects of London's culture scene. But first of all, here's David Spencer with the news headlines.
Clemency, thank you very much indeed. The worst bushfires in New South Wales for several decades are continuing to threaten hundreds of homes near Sydney. Authorities have warned that several of the fires could converge over the next few days. A suicide bomber driving a minibus has killed at least 38 people in Iraq. He blew himself up outside a cafe in a mainly Shiite Muslim district of Baghdad late on Sunday. Talks between India and Russia will begin today, with trade, nuclear energy and defence set to be the focus. India's Prime Minister Manmohan Singh arrived in Moscow on Sunday ahead of a meeting with President Vladimir Putin today. A Roma couple are due in court in Greece later today, charged with abducting a young blonde girl found living with them. DNA tests show she was not related to the pair, and police have received thousands of calls from the public after an appeal to try and identify her. French utility company EDF and the British government have signed an agreement to build two nuclear reactors for a total cost of £16 billion. Two Chinese companies are part of the deal to build Britain's first nuclear power plant for a generation. The European Court of Human Rights is to rule on Russia's handling of its investigation into a 1940 massacre of more than 20,000 Polish war prisoners by Soviet secret police. Soviet Russia only admitted to the atrocity in 1990 after blaming the Nazis for five decades. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, David. We'll see you again at the top of the hour. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Marcus Hippie. In this week's episode of Culture, we have a Midori House session from Gavin James and tune in to New York's CMJ Music Marathon. We'll get literary in a variety of ways and have a full rundown of the Frieze Art Fair that wrapped up here in London yesterday.
But in this preview, we move away from the fair to visit The Strand. The gallery, together with The Vinyl Factory, have put on a show full of theatricality and horror. The show, under the title of Brutal, features 20 artists displaying a series of ambitious paintings, installations and performances set amongst piles of rubble and broken pipelines.
Well, as you might expect, the show harnesses the edgier aspects of London's art scene. A pop-up soup kitchen is in situ to feed the masses, and film installations snag visitors with an experience rather than presenting them with a gallery catalogue. Monocle's Jack Phillips met gallery director Steve Lazaridis to talk about the show and talk about why Brutal offers something a little different.
I run the Lazaridis Gallery and putting on another ridiculous exhibition whilst Freeze is on. It's our sixth kind of adventure into stupidity. So we did auction in a strip bar in the Shadow Lounge 6 years ago. Then we did the shutdown show where we had Tempin Gnomin, where you had to bowl and smash ceramic gnomes in amongst an art show. Then we did the 3 years at the Old Vic Tunnels, and now we're with the Vinyl Factory at 180 The Strand. So it's our sixth adventure. It doesn't get any easier.
And can you explain about the actual location? Because it is a massive, cavernous underground. It looks like an absolute organized wreck.
It's situated in like a beautiful brutalist building. Like, for me, I love brutalist architecture. And when the Vinyl Factory came to show me the space at the beginning, because I was going to take a year off, I was going to do a Glastonbury and thought, I've had enough of kind of all the stress, we'll take a year off. And I was worried that we wouldn't find a venue that would be as good as the Old Vic Tunnels. And then I came in about 6 or 7 months ago with the Vinyl Factory, and it was like, wow, yeah, we kind of need to do a show. We are in a tiny portion of like a 600,000 square foot derelict brutalist building right on like 180 The Strand. So it's just down from King's College. And it's amazing to find space like this in London, and especially finding the space and finding someone that has a vision to let you come in and actually use it. You know, you can find these spaces, but finding these spaces and getting to use them is two completely separate things. It was inspiring for me, and hence the name Brutal for the show. And then I think the artists, you know, you've had a look around the show, I think the artists have really got their teeth into, you know, working with the space and working with the theme.
And I think that's one thing that you definitely get when you walk around the show, is that you're confronted by this massive building, and certain little dainty artworks could easily get lost. So I was wondering, can you run through particularly what we're seeing at the moment, how they've interacted with that space?
Well, we've got some epic pieces in here. You know, we're stood right in front of Cleon Peterson, who's an artist from LA, who's done probably, I don't know, what's that, a 50-foot mural. We're stood next to lots of very dangerous hanging sheets of glass suspended from the ceiling. We have a sunken forest over in the corner with about 20 trees in it in a flooded pool. In the background, you can kind of hear a short film that James Favell's made. Doug Foster's done an epic video installation. Kareem's done another video installation. We have a soup kitchen, all the fun of the fair. And the guys have really stepped up. Each artist really has done their own installation. And this show is good, even though it's a vast space. I think for me, it's the most accomplished show we've done, and each artist has their own space to breathe. Even though it's huge, it doesn't feel empty. And also the art doesn't feel like it's all piled on top of each other.
Do you feel, I mean, I saw Todd James at the Lazaridis show last year at the Rathbone Place, and I've seen Conor Harrington quite a few times at the Outsiders in Soho. What is it that draws you to doing these annual shows? Is it a showcase? Is it, because I know you obviously that you're averse to fairs.
Yeah, I guess for me, I want to be Barnum. I want to put on the greatest show on earth, and you know, and it's lovely to work with like a bunch of brilliant artists that can step up to the mark. And for me, it's the antithesis to something like Freeze. It's like, you know, Freeze is great for some things, but essentially it's a fair. It's there just to sell artworks. And it's no one's putting shows on, and this is the antithesis of putting on interesting show for people to come along to. It's a fantastically non-commercial exercise by me each year to try and put on a great show for the London public, because I think that the fair doesn't really appeal to the public per se. I think it's more a very specific strata of society, and where our things here, we get, you know, we'll hopefully get 10,000 people to come through. So it's for the general public to come and view. It's free. That's what it's there for. It's for the normal people to come and be terrified and enjoy themselves.
And yeah, is that where the theatrics become involved? Because there is so much going on here. There's noises, and there's, I wonder if you could talk about the user experience of having to come around and actually look at these works.
Well, there's lots of sound, there's lots of video installation. Also within it, we've got five young lads in a Breaking Bones crew that do some very extreme form of dance. So you'll be wandering around the show and suddenly five lads stripped to the waist with gas masks on will be running through the thing, dragging metal bars and doing insane dance moves. So yeah, it's a full-on user experience. Enjoy, use it, that's what it's here for. As long as you guys keep coming, I'll keep doing it.
And I suppose what I actually want to cover a little bit more is the term brutal. What sort of ethos or manifest did the individual artists come to be able to sort of hit that mark?
It was a very open brief. So it was riffing off the actual architecture of the building. I thought it was quite a non-specific term for the art as well. And I'm trying to explain to him that brutal could be the nature of what's depicted in the art, but it could also be the way the art's made or the way it's painted, or it's whatever the artist wants to take from it. You know, I kind of feel like I'm a venue manager and these guys are the bands. So I'm not going to tell them what to play. So it was giving them a relatively free brief to come and do something interesting.
Although you have come on for somewhat of a star appearance in one of the pieces, haven't you? Let's talk about that. Let's not pass out.
Mark Jenkins is here, who makes street sculpture. We had a space here, which is like a big hole in the floor with loads of coloured pipes in. And I was worried that everyone thought I'd have gone batshit crazy and was doing insane conceptual art. So Mark designed a piece to go in there, which is me being body cast hidden under the rubble, which I think a lot of people would like to do.
At the very end, you are all alone.
That was Steve Lazaridis, art gallerist and curator, talking with Monocle's Jack Phillips for this week's episode of Culture. You can catch the full interview and more cultural highlights a bit later at 1900 hours London time, that is at 7 a.m. in Auckland and 1400 hours in New York City.
Meanwhile, it's 8:40 here in London and you're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a check of the Spanish news with our man in Barcelona, Liam Aldous.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorme. From Monocle.
From Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dan.
From Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're back with Midori House with me, Clemency Burton-Hill and Marcos Hippie. The time is 16:42 in Tokyo, 8:42 here in London. And it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the globe. And today we are turning to Liam Aldous, Monocle's man in Spain. He's normally in Madrid, but joins us on the line this morning from Barcelona, where he's undertaking numerous Monocle assignments for us, everything from the entrepreneurs to culture and the menu. Liam, it's very kind of you to give us a few moments of your time, given that you are so busy already for Monocle.
I always have time for both of you.
Oh, well, it's lovely to have you on the show. You're in Barcelona, so you're right in the heart of Catalunya. That means you should probably, I guess, give us a handle on what's going on with the ongoing issue of independence.
Yeah, the never-ending story of independence. So there's been a couple of developments in the last week, one of which was the handing over or the presentation of this 50-page document which lists the grievances that Barcelona has with Madrid. So there was a long list of all the money, basically, that the central government still owes Barcelona. And they interestingly included the money that's still owing on pending investment projects as well. So this underlines the theory that a lot of this move towards independence is based on money and the raw deal that Barcelona feels it has from Madrid regarding taxes and money from the central government.
And what does Catalonia actually want to achieve with this report?
Basically, they're trying to increase pressure on Rajoy to negotiate. Basically, for the last few weeks, he's refused to even budge, even a proposal from his own party leader in the region to redesign the financing deal in Barcelona was rejected, flatly rejected, and she was left a little red face in one of the conferences last week in Madrid. So they're really upping the pressure and hoping that Rajoy comes to the negotiating table, but he's still refusing to budge.
The right-hand man of the Catalan regional premier, Artur Mas, says he's given an interview in El País, from what I understand, and pointing out that the grievances that Catalonia feels towards the capital are not so much about Spain per se, but more with the institutions which prevent the region from achieving the sort of political and policy freedom that they require. Tell us more.
Yeah, exactly. This this stems from the rejection of the Estatut, or the Catalan the Catalan Constitution, sorry, that was overturned by the Constitutional Court a few years ago. But also the introduction of the approval of the latest national education reform, which also interferes in the region's ability to have its own education policy and also speak its own language in the schools, is a huge grievance in Catalonia. So this was just been in the news for the last couple of weeks. So he's actually said something quite interesting as well. A lot of the critics who say that if Catalonia declares independence, they will find themselves outside of the European Union. And he shot back saying that if the European Union chooses to expel 7 million Catalans, then Europe as a project would have failed. So these are fighting words from Francesc Homs, who's known as one of the main ideologues pushing for independence.
Leah, moving on to your second story. Spain's Prime Minister Rajoy has attended an Ibero-American summit in Panama that wasn't a massive success.
No, it's a bit of an ailing summit. It's the Ibero-Americano summit it was held in Panama this year, which basically brings what's meant to bring all the Latin American nations together with Spain. But only 12 of the 20 leaders actually attended. So it's not a very good turnout. And even the Spanish king, who's recovering from surgery, wasn't able to attend. Cristina Fernandez from Argentina was actually also quite sick. A few could actually excuse themselves for being sick, but a lot of them just reject the importance of this summit. A lot of them prefer to engage in other summits with Europe, and not just specifically with Spain and Portugal, which they think they no longer need them to hold their hand when dealing with Europe. So Rajoy was there trying to talk up Spain's economic recovery, but the summit it's not in good shape.
Did anything significant emerge from it?
Well, there has been a proposal to elaborate on a policy to create this Erasmus or student exchange project with Latin America and Spain and Portugal. This is a good move and could benefit both sides, but the summit itself is actually another thing they actually agreed on is to actually meet only every 2 years from now on. So if that's the only thing they can agree on, it's not looking good.
And indeed, looking at how empty this summit was, what does the future look like for Spain-Latin American cooperation?
Well, it's quite good. I mean, the it's kind of turned on its head, because Spain has invested something like 200 billion euros over the last decade in Latin America, and it was kind of interesting to see Rajoy there, basically with cap in hand, asking for Latin American corporations to come and invest in Spain. So it's this power shift that's basically the narrative that's coming out of the summit. So if Spain can maneuver to try and work the change in power to its advantage, it could greatly benefit, but it depends on the diplomatic wrangling that it's capable of.
Meanwhile, a blast from the past politically. The ex-Prime Minister José Luis Zapatero has broken his 2 year silence. I understand he gave a big TV interview last night. What was on the agenda?
Yes, he's back. He actually has refused to talk for the last 2 years, basically claiming that he wants to give the government clean air to for its policies and not really affect the economic recovery of the country, saying that if he criticizes the government, it will affect the government's credibility, although the government lately has been doing a lot to affect its own credibility regarding corruption, a huge corruption scandal. But he was basically on TV talking about Rajoy needs to negotiate with the whole Catalan issue, and he says that probably a whole reform of the constitution is necessary to really protect the singularity of the states. And he also voiced a few concerns. He did kind of subtly voice a few concerns that he's worried about the unraveling of the welfare state, and saying that Spain came to the welfare state party quite late, 40 years later than the rest of Europe, and he's worried that Spain won't be able to enjoy the benefits of welfare and universal education like the rest of Europe.
How much do you think Prime Minister Rajoy listened to these thoughts and this feedback?
I don't think they'll listen too much, to be honest, but Zapatero's words are quite significant, because he hasn't talked for so long. It's actually front page news today, so a lot of the people in the PP don't want to negotiate with the Catalan issue. And if it were the socialists in power, they probably would propose to change the constitution. So this could be one of the main tools in the elections in a couple of years for people who are fed up with all these independence issues and want some real change.
Liam Aldous, we'll have to leave it there. But thank you very much for joining us from Barcelona this morning, not Madrid. Our man usually based on the ground in Madrid, but as I mentioned, doing all sorts of other work for Monocle. We're looking forward to hearing the fruits of your labour.
We'll be having a run through of the Brazilian papers in a moment, but to take us there, here is some music from Vanessa da Mata with Ai Ai Ai. That was Vanessa da Mata with Ai Ai Ai.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Marcos Hippie, and it's 8.51 in London. Joining us now for a run-through of the Brazilian front pages is our star researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. A very good morning to you, Fernando.
Good morning to you both.
Let's start with O Globo. We were just hearing from Liam Aldous in Spain that the former Prime Minister had given his first interview in 2 years last night in Spain, and that had obviously caused a lot of interest on the front pages in Spain this morning. Similar situation in Brazil.
Exactly.
Where you have Lula da Silva's just given an interview for the first time in a long time to El País Semanal.
Not for a Brazilian newspaper, but for a Spanish one. But of course, the Brazilian press picked up on that, because it's funny, because Lula, he doesn't really give interviews, you know. So I was quite surprised myself, because I usually buy the El País over the weekend, and I was like, oh, a lengthy interview with Lula. How interesting. And it's quite like an 8-page. And of course, O Globo, he kind of summarized what he said. And one of the things that Lula said, that actually, because of the growth of the Workers' Party in the last 33 years, he kind of admitted that there's been some corruption cases in his own party. And he said it's time to give voice for a new generation in his party as well. And he also, well, maybe that's why he didn't give an interview to Brazilian media. He kind of criticized the way the Brazilian media handled the corruption cases in his government, saying that in the center-right governments, they were not as kind of confrontational. Which, I mean, I kind of agree with him slightly, you know, because the media in Brazil usually is more center-right, even though the population, they usually vote more to the left.
Do you think this quite long interview may have some actual consequences in Brazil?
I think so. I mean, he's such a charismatic figure. Actually, in fact, if he decided to become the candidate for president next year, he would win on the first round. But of course, I think he's a smart guy as well. He wouldn't like to do that, because then people will say that he wants to try to be a dictator or something. So he's very smart. I don't think he would be a candidate ever again, in my opinion.
Let's move over to a different story, but in the same newspaper, about the toughening up of laws in Brazil. It's getting pretty draconian, some are saying.
Quite draconian.
First of all, you had the fact that you can't drink a single drop of alcohol if you're going to drive, and now some pretty stiff fines if you drop any litter.
If you drop any litter, basically you'll be fine. But that's a law only in the city of Rio de Janeiro. And it started 2 months ago. And when they introduced the law, people say, oh, nobody's going to really fine you. But actually, more than 7,600 people were fined already. And the worst place to be fined is downtown Rio, Copacabana and Leblon, which, funnily enough, are the most touristic places in Rio as well. So if you're in Rio, don't throw any litter, or don't drink alcohol if you're going
to tell
drive.
The England fans coming to Rio for the World Cup.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, what are they going to be doing with all the tourists then?
Oh, and please take a lot of money, because, you know, there's been some stories here on the British press, because Brazil is becoming so expensive. And flights in Brazil during the World Cup, it's so expensive.
I know flights are going to be expensive and so on, but how much is the fine going to be then if you drop, you know, something on the street?
Well, the fine, I mean, it's not that expensive. It's like something like around 500 rios, you know, which is going to be almost £200, something like that. You know,
oh, but
it's
dropping,
not much.
It's
you just
not
said.
Much. Yeah, I thought you were going to say a fiver.
Yeah.
Wait, so that's for dropping any single piece of litter. You could get fined
exactly
£200,
like
$300.
Cigarettes or food,
wow,
or anything. So
it doesn't really. It's quite counterintuitive, because I think the image of Brazil, especially for those of us who've never been or who don't live there, is sort of, you know, it's quite laid back and liberal. So the idea that, you know, you get fined quite a hefty sum for dropping a chocolate wrapper.
Be careful. But you both have a place to stay in the World Cup if you want. You can stay with me.
I'm going to take you. I'm glad that there are listeners who've got. We've now got witnesses to this statement. Faye.
It's great, because anyway, I may be quite skint if I accidentally drop my chocolate wrapper. Anyway, another story now from Folha de São Paulo. There's a dog story, essentially. What's been going on?
Essentially, and it's been everywhere in the press. It's quite interesting. I mean, you know, Brazilian, we're loving to protest at the moment, right? And now there's a place called Institute Royal, which they do test animals, but to test for the adverse effect of drugs. And they had 178 beagles there. But for some reason, there's been online, they released the address of the institute. So a lot of protesters, they went there, they invaded Institute Royal. They got all the beagles and they left the place. But it was quite a violent, you know, they really invaded. There was people working there. And I know, I love beagles. Mind you, I would love to adopt a rescue beagle myself. But a lot of journalists, they said, why the story has caused such a commotion in people, why there's so many stories about child poverty, child prostitution, nobody really cares about it. But when you involve beagles on the story, you know, it's a completely different story, you know. I'm not saying nothing against the beagles and nothing against the animal rights activists. I think you can blame the media as well.
Well, especially if the testing is to help, you know, with medical research or scientific
exactly.
research. It's not just that there's cruelty for cruelty's sake. This has obviously led to major controversy and protests, as you said, which seems to be chiming with the protests everywhere. We saw, obviously, mass protests earlier in the summer. We saw last week petrol bombs being thrown after protests in favour of striking teachers. And, of course, today we've got this huge story coming out of Brazil, which is the oil auction roundup. That's obviously causing a huge amount of unquiet, and I know that the oil workers are striking. That could shut down 40 platforms, I believe, on the thing.
And there's more protests lined up to happen in Rio today, where the auction is happening in a hotel in Tijuca. And you can see here on the folio, on cover of Folha de São Paulo, you know, the streets are heavily policized now, actually. But there's quite a nice picture, I have to say. There's a surfer walking around the policeman. Can you see that, the picture?
It's a good Brazilian image there, surfer with a whole load of armed police. Fernando, I think that's all we have time for today. Lovely to have you on the show, as ever.
Thank you, Fernando. That's indeed all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Annabel Bly, our researchers, Fernando August Pacheco, our Fernando, and Andrea Alarcón, and our studio manager was Chris Gilvers. Today, up next after the news, is The Urbanist, hosted by Andrew Tuck. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday in London and at 7 a.m. in New York. Phil Hahn and Dyke Enright will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, but now from me, Markus Hippi.
And me, Clemency Burton Hill, thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time, it tells history. Rolex.